Formula Access, welcome. We bring the people of motorsports to your doorstep, and yet again, Red Bull has delivered us another amazing person from another title. You guys, I'm really, really big about keeping our titles completely different on every episode, so you all get a feeling for the different roles that go into this incredible sport. Today, we have Katie. She's from Red Bull. Katie, welcome, and thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. That was a lovely introduction.
Well, I've had a nice 25 minutes to talk to you before we even started. I wish I would have recorded it. And then we could just dive into the conversation, but I guess we can go back or get there at some point. But I really appreciate you coming on. And again, I always feel like when you get a big name or a big team, it gets harder and harder to like give the fans just a type of engagement. And Red Bull has been just absolutely stellar in the pedigree and the quality of guests that they've sent over and allowed you to come on as well. And, you know, you are one of the few left where I can still just message online and have a conversation with. So thank you for being open and not thinking I'm a scam artist or whatever. I've heard that too.
Not at all. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So Katie, just for all the fans, what do you do today? What do you do for Red Bull?
So I work in the Eternal Comms team, which is part of the broader marketing team. So we're very much focused on talking to the team around the campus in sort of a way that they want to be spoken to. So whether that's looking at the media to share a message, i.e. a video versus an email versus the intranet or a debrief with Christian, just trying to engage with everybody in the factory. So many different roles means so many different sort of styles of person, how they want to be spoken to and what they find engaging. So we are sort of tasked with finding that sweet spot and delivering messages in various ways and seeing what works.
Okay, so that you're like an internal marketing agency?
Kind of. So it's a super broad role. I'm not going to lie, we get roped into a ton of things. So it's from, say, sending a to-all about, hey, we've got mental health training courses, like come and be a mental health first aider, engage with this. Or it is doing an interview with a member of staff about maybe a D&I course they've been on and what they took away from it and why others should do it. Or we also partner with Wings for Life, who is our sister charity. They're a spinal cord research charity. And we work with them on putting on events. We work on the strategy for raising funds. And so all of that combined into one role, no two days are ever the same, which it's you come in one day, you're like, what are we doing? But that's why I love it. Like for me, that's awesome.
Yeah, you are like me. It is very much, I can't get into the robot lifestyle of like every day is the same. I get bored and distracted. I've got this like mental, gotta punch a hole in the universe personality and keep things changed up. I remember when I went from a normal job to starting a company, I had spoken with a mentor of mine and was just like, it was like the personal self-doubt where you're kind of like your own worst critic and you're like, this is dumb. Why should I do this? And I'm not built for this. I'm not cut out for this. And so I was asking him, I'm like, what are the traits that you see in a lot of entrepreneurs? You know, do I have that? You know, and he was like the best entrepreneurs in the world surround themselves with very, very smart people and capable people. And they just walk around and drop hand grenades and everything. It's like, there's a better way of doing that. Just stop it. You know, and those amazing people come and like they clean that mess up and make it like the vision of that person. And I always thought, I guess I could channel like being a really good bulldozer to like a hand grenade dropper. Like, I guess those go hand in hand, and that has created that very like change. I would love a role like yours where it's just kind of like, can you do this? Can you help out here? Can you help this? Can you help a sister company? And,
yeah, I mean, for me, it's super because, you know, when you're asked to do something that you've never done before, like that can be super daunting. Like, I want to do a great job. Everyone does. And, you know, there's that nervousness of, okay, what if I really mess this up? But as you said, there are so many people to learn from. You've just got to reach out there and ask the questions. Like, don't be shy. We don't all know everything. So that's exactly what I did. Like exactly what you said. Okay, they're great at this. I'm going to find out how they're so good at it or what tips they have. And you kind of absorb all this information and then all of a sudden you're doing it. And you're like, hey, oh, I learned a thing. Excellent. And that's sort of what keeps me going. Like, I love to learn. And, you know, if you get to an end of the day, you're like, I nailed that, you know. That's what keeps me coming back to work. I'm like, right, what are we doing this time?
You said something in your role that I thought was interesting. So you, you'll do like communication style videos. So like if there's a message that Christian wants to send to the team or anyone in the team that wants to get this out, you create like interview style videos or just presentation style videos to like start initiatives or.
Yeah, so they are very much interview based. So I'll be the one sat behind the camera asking the questions. My voice isn't usually included. So, you know, it's kind of like, when I ask you a question, please remember to include the question in your answer, because it's more like a monologue versus, you know, a two-way conversation. And that's something I'd never done before as well. For the first time I ever did it, it was the topic was about Pride Month. And so we have a network, LGBTQ+ network, and a couple of them volunteered to be interviewed. I was like, this is fantastic. I'm really passionate about the subject as well. This is great. So wrote some questions, sent them to them. And my first thing is don't write a script, because this is going to be a conversation. So don't sit there trying to remember something that you've written down like yesterday, because that's going to come off really poorly. So that was first thing. And I met the videographer in the morning, and we'd never met before. He's done a ton like trackside across all sort of like big media outlets. So for me to meet him, I'm like, okay, this guy's the real deal. This is really cool. And you know, we're kind of chatting and I'm asking him, so what's a good interviewer do? He was like, firstly, like when they answer a question, try not to react straight away, because we got to edit you out. I was like, oh, okay. Because, you know, I also forget. I want the people in front of the camera to forget it's there. Then I forget it's there. And I'm like, oh, damn, I just totally spoke over you. Like, can you do it again? So that all started. And then I met the folks that I was interviewing. A couple of them I'd never met before either. And so I was like, okay, here's the deal. I've never done this before. You've never done this before. We're all kind of nervous. So let's just kind of get rid of that first. Like, let's get to know each other. Just like me and you did. We had a little chat. Okay, this is still a bit weird. So we sat down. We started talking with the camera rolling. And we just had fun. It was really nice in the end. Like, we had a bit of a laugh. Of course, there were bits we needed to cut out. There was a couple of swears put out there. But, you know, everyone does. And in the end, like, it was a really like moving piece. It was so heartfelt and just genuine. I was like, that was awesome. Like, let's do that again. So that's just like one thing. Like, and this wasn't even that long ago. This was like this Pride Month just gone. And so I'm like, that was really cool. So yeah.
What is the effect of something like that in the company? Is it better than just sending a memo or a social media post and tagging your teams? So, like, what is the impact of that exercise in the team?
Sure. I mean, I always think First and foremost, I always think, okay, what would I think if I received like a memo about, say, Pride Month? I'm very much like a I'm very skeptical, and I'm like, okay, who wrote this? You know, did this come straight from HR? Is this actually a real person? Like, who even said this? Do you know? Where if you've got a video, the emotion is there, like it's really raw and it's hard to fake. And I think also by just showing our people, so we're really small business, really. We're looking at what, 1400 people for the most part, on one campus by two buildings, and we see each other around the factory all the time, albeit you probably don't know their names or what they do or what department they sit in, but you see them, you say hi. And I think then to receive a message and you're like, oh, hey, it's that person I saw in the canteen the other week. Oh, they're talking about it. Oh, right, okay. And it just makes it a lot more personal and relatable versus a bit of black and white that you know, it's really hard to get emotion from a piece of paper unless it's like a novel or something.
I'm always looking for ways to unify teams. I've always been fascinated with Navy SEALs, and you know, these are like the equivalent of F1 drivers in the military. They're the highest at the highest level. You know, they're very dedicated to what they do. They're very focused, and you know, and I think in a Formula One team, you have a very united structure, which means, you know, you're going to help your teammates out in any way possible that you can, because the objective is to win races, and it's very clear. And I'm always looking for ways, like in other business and other companies, to unify teams and communicate messages, because we all know in any company with more than like 10 people, you start to get clicky, you start to get groupings, you start to get like different departments segregate from other departments, and then you know, and then the chatter, well, that department does this, department does that, and they like this, or they don't like that, and like I'm always looking for ways to unite teams so that everybody is aware of where everyone is. So it's like no more superficial. And I love the concept of interview style communication of like, here's the message, here's what I'm saying, here's how I feel, here are my thoughts around this particular subject. And now everybody is aware of that. And if it's done right, you know, it can be captivating. Like when I asked you the question of a memo, of course, everybody takes the memo and they delete it. They put it in a box or they throw it in the trash can, versus a video of somebody with a captivating story. You know, you're kind of like, what's happening? That sounds like actually a really fun job.
It is. It really is. Like, not only do I get to, you know, meet these folks and, you know, create more relationships across the campus, I think just being able to deliver something like that, it kind of shows the bond that we do have with one another. Like, we are very much a walk across, say hi to the person you spoke to like 20 times and you ain't got a clue who they are, but we do, we smile, we're like, hey, how are you doing, you know, how's the kids, and you don't even know who they are, like, yeah. Which we laugh about sometimes. That actually happened to me this week. We've got a guy in finance going doing a talk in a school, and I was helping sorting him out with like a team polo to wear whilst he's there, and he came to my desk to collect it, and I've seen this guy so many times before, and I was like, oh, this is you, oh, hey. Which is, it's nuts, but you know, that's just the reality of having so many people in one campus, I guess.
Yeah, you guys are, you have a really neat story as a team, because I think Christian said this in a Drive to Survive episode, that you guys are like the Mavericks of Formula One. And I've always remembered that comment because it's so true. It's, you know, you're not a manufacturer. You weren't at the time. You know, you're basically like the equivalent of an independent. And, you know, you brought on really smart people with a very, like, the plan of Nui was before anyone, before Nui arrived at the team. Like, it was so far thought out and, you know, and executed well, but functioned so much like my world of startups or small business, which was like, oh, all those impossible things you say we can't do as an independent team, we've accomplished them. And we've actually superseded normalcy. Like, we're not Braun, where we won a championship and then the field was leveled. It was, we come in and we dominate an era, you know, and you've done this, you're on your second run of that. And I think that is that maverick entrepreneurial mentality that you guys have. And I just, like, I've always loved that about the culture of Red Bull. And you take everything so seriously. You know,
yes,
like,
yeah.
Stefan on, and like, he takes the creative aspect of his role so, like, the brand, the colors, the garage, like, you take that so, so seriously. And I think that's what ultimately results in the output.
100%. There is not a single person that doesn't work hard at the business. You know, it can be intense. Any business can. But that being said, when it does come off and there is a win, it's like, yes, you know, it's, but then the week after it's like, okay, we go again. And it's not an expectation at all. And you know, it's almost like this season's been ridiculous. Like, it's like, is this really happening? Like, what? And you know, you walk around the factory, and as I've said, I'm just going to reiterate on the point that the asking the questions with folks, you know, even though everyone is so, so busy, no one's ever told me no. I've never asked for help or asked a question and been told to go to someone else. That's never happened. It's always, hey, you know, let's grab coffee, let's have a chat, you know, and that, I think, pulls into the whole team mentality. We are very much a team. It's not just the race team that travel, it's the entire business as a team. You know, if one area isn't succeeding, then as a team we're not succeeding. And you really feel that. It's really nice to be a part of.
How do you define success in internal communications? I've always been in sales.
Mm-hmm.
Selling is my, I guess, solving problems and selling stuff has always been my definition of success. But in that particular role, where do you find fulfillment? Where do you view success in that role?
So I think, you know, multiple chances. So the first one, I guess it's got to be talking about our debriefs, our race debriefs. We had one just after we'd won the championship, and we're like, okay, we got to make this special, right? And we had this really fun idea of getting some confetti cannons. And on the way in, I was like, hey, would you let a confetti cannon off? Like, there's a trigger word. And they'd be like, yeah, okay, great. I'm like, okay, keep it concealed, go and hide. Christian opened the debrief up. He said the trigger word, and bam, I had like 30 of these confetti cannons go off at the same time. And like, the people like jumping out of their skin, like the photos are incredible. So there's just confetti everywhere, like, God bless the cleaners. And just, you know, seeing that look, that moment, that was it. Well, it's feedback, isn't it? You could see, okay, nailed that moment. To the more, you know, black and white numbers, like the statistics on the back of things we put out there. How many folks have clicked on this? How many people have viewed this video? And then from the Wings for Lives perspective, that's the cash. It's how much have we actually raised? And you know, we have like a ballpark figure at the beginning of the year. We're like, oh, that's ambitious. And you know, the more the year goes on, and we get these incredible experiences that we'll put up for auction, or we'll have events that we'll ticket. You know, you get there in increments. So I think from internal comms, it's quite multifaceted. You know, it's numbers, it's qualitative and quantitative. There you go. that emotive feedback, and then also the stats. So it's very much a mix for us.
With your particular role, like, where does this role lead within the organization of Red Bull, or just Formula One in general? Like, what becomes the long-term objective? Like, any aerodynamicist wants to become Adrian Newey. So what, mm-hmm. like, what's the path for you?
That's a really good question. I can't say I've actually thought about the answer. Because, you know, for me, I'd say I'm a little bit like a Mary Poppins, you know, you go where the wind takes you type thing. You know, all my career has been a little bit like that, to be honest with you. And so I still don't know where I'm going, but something will come up and I'll get there, you know. And this is probably my downfall as well. Like, since like doing qualifications and going to uni, I never knew what I wanted to do or where I wanted to be. And as you do roles or study subjects, you get a feel for something. You're like, oh, let's see where we get with this. Yeah. You learn some stuff that then can be applied to something else that might tickle your fancy. Then you go and do that for a bit. So that's a really hard question for me to answer, because I legitimately don't know what it is.
Well, on the note of career advancement, you did start at the team in fan engagement.
I did.
Which I as a fan myself, I always think is a really, really good conversation topic of that. Like, because I do think that Formula One, you know, gets a bad rep of fan engagement, but they actually do a really good job of fan engagement. You know, I think it where the sport has struggled is you have IndyCar, which is a very indie series, I guess. It's small relative to the size and scale of Formula One, where, like, you know, you can go to a car, like at a race, you know, you can be 5 feet away from the car. And I just think of, like, that's a spec series, so it's okay because they're all the same. There's no secrets. Whereas if you get to Formula One, everything is like R&D, it's intellectual property, it's quarantined off, and like for a very specific reason. Mm-hmm. And I think people don't take those two kind of concepts into account, that, you know, hey, if I let everyone 5 feet within a Red Bull car, you know, what could they do by just standing there and like sketching it out, taking pictures, whatever that is. But what is that role like at Red Bull specifically?
Yeah, so the fan engagement at Red Bull, like, we understand that Formula One isn't a massively accessible sport. It's super expensive to go to a race. You know, it's expensive to sign up to the subscription media to watch a race to even begin with. So we, as you said, Mavericks, we recognize that our fans don't all have the disposable income to you know, enjoy F1. So how can we take the team and the sport to them? How can we best give our fans the opportunity to get close to the team? So, you know, we got the Paddock, which is our loyalty program. We launched that a couple of years ago. And we're like, okay, so we've got this fan base. What do they want? Right, they want to get closer to us. So we did a ton of competitions to meet the drivers, come for a meet and greet. And so I remember one that we did in Canada, I think 2 years ago. And we reached out to our Canadian fans. We're like, hey, you know, we're going to have Checo in the Hard Rock, you know, sign up, basically. And we had random fans were selected to come for this meet and greet. And we were super careful in terms of not disclosing the location and the time until we'd got this, I think it was like 20 people maybe with a plus one. So it was like, we're only going to communicate to these folks where it is and what time. And before you know it, we've got crowds outside. We got to get security barriers up. And I'm like, oh, okay, that escalated quickly. But we didn't want to let that stop us from continuing doing it, because like, we know this is a good thing to be doing. So just because every man and his dogs ended up showing up, that means we've got to be smarter. We're not going to blame the fans for turning up. You're going to. So we're like, okay, that's on us. Okay, we need to be a bit smarter when we do this going forward. And so, you know, there is risks, like you said, okay, what can they get from being close to the car? And I think we do trust our fans. You know, if you're a fan of the team, you're not going to expose our secrets. You know, and you wouldn't get anywhere without that element of trust, I think. And we just want to give fans, like, you know, come on, well, we welcome you in. We're not going to like pat you down on the way in. Come on in. It's that sort of mentality. We did some fan zones as well last year. They were various locations across the globe. And even though there wasn't a car there and we weren't trackside, like, hey, you know, come and chat with us. We had a bunch of signed stuff that we gave out, you know, and there was this one time we're in Amsterdam, and there was this really young bunch of fans. They were brother and sister, and they were so excited to see us, so excited to be going to the race. Like, I think for one of them, it was like the first race ever, like massive Max fan. And we had a couple of paddock passes to just give out. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of let them come in. They interacted with the staff. And then on the way, I ran after them. I was like, do you guys fancy coming in the paddock? You know, do you want to meet Max? And honestly, the look on this girl's face, she was like, you're not serious. I was like, no, like, yeah, I am. And honestly, it was like I made her entire year. And it's like, for me, I was like, oh my goodness, like, I just want to take you home. But it was just, that's what we should be doing.
Yeah.
And that's what's wanted from our fans. So it's delivering the unexpected and just going above and beyond for them. Because let's be honest, if they're not here watching the sport, then we're nothing. You know, we don't exist. And that's very much how we see our fan base. Like, we respect and appreciate that. We don't take it for granted. And so we're always trying to think of new ways of giving them what they want and bringing them closer to us.
What created the change or the shift for you professionally to go from a very direct fan to an internal communications
block? Yeah. So I'm a project manager. So even before like the campaign stuff, I was brought on to sort of implement the tech side. So the Oracle platforms, working with our IT team, working with the Oracle specialists, working with fan engagement head of, and kind of pulling all of those folks together and getting this stuff up and running first and foremost. So that was like a whole half year of work. And I'd never sort of done the marketing side of things before. And, you know, naturally working with the software, I'm like, oh, this is kind of neat. Like, this is fun. You know, and having that sort of conversation and sort of, you know, the intrigue and wanting to get involved in something more marketing, my manager was like, do you fancy giving the Christmas campaign a go this year? I was like, really? She's like, yeah, like, you know, no promises, but if you've got an idea, let's hear it. And so I literally grabbed a sheet of A3 paper and a bunch of colored pens and drew up this little storyboard of Max and Checo. And it was like every sort of scene had an item in it, and the item the fans could sign up to like win it. And it told a little story. I was like, what, is this any good? She's like, oh, yeah, that works. I was like, okay, this is nuts. And so reached out to an illustrator to digify these scrolls of mine. And that was, I can't even tell you how nuts that was to be like, okay, this has gone from my trash piece of paper, which I've still got, to this beautiful illustration that then forms this digital campaign. I was like, oh, wow, okay. Yeah, and you know, that wasn't totally all me, like, for sure. Like I've said, you've got to find folks that are good and know what they're doing and learn from them. So it's me going to the social team and saying, hey, you know, would this work? Going to the web team who run the paddock, like, okay, can we actually get a sign-up mechanism for this? Is this doable on our side? And then figuring out the cadence of how we post it and, you know, the actual prizes. Are the prizes any good? Are people going to want this? You know, so it was a whole conversation with so many different people to make it work. And so, as I said, like, it wasn't a planned move. It was just kind of, hey, do you want to give it a go? I was like, yeah, sure, let's give it a go. And then the experiential stuff was a little bit more closer to home because it was like tangible events. It was like getting stuff from A to B, getting it on freight, getting it set up, making sure that the location had like all the planning maps and the health and safety stuff. And, you know, it was a bit more, okay, I tick these things off. This stuff's going to turn up. We open, we close. That's that. And then the move into internal comms, again, started off with the project management piece. We were doing a rehaul of the intranet. So back working with my pals in IT and sort of figuring out, okay, this is definitely a step-by-step process. It's still ongoing. As you can imagine, we've got a ton of stuff on the intranet. But we're like, okay, what does it need to look like? Where do the buttons go? You know, how are people going to know how to use it? Like all these kind of things. So again, that was a bit more of a mapping out, setting up a working group, getting feedback, doing, going through test scripts and making sure all the buttons work and things like that. Before more moving into the marketing side of internal comms and then going into the actual producing an interview or thinking about the wording of an email, the tone, all that kind of thing. So it's been a journey.
So kicking into your origin story here.
Sure.
You weren't like ride or die motorsports like growing up as a kid. Like, how did all this start? Not that I'm aware of, but like, how did all this start?
Yeah, I mean, my sort of earliest memory of F1, my dad had it up on the TV, and I don't know, I was probably waiting on a Saturday to go out with my mates or something, I don't know, and I'm just kind of sat watching it, and I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, oh, this looks a bit crazy. Like, oh, there's a crash. Like, I was like, what are you watching, Dad? And it was like back in the Jenson Button days, and he was like, oh, you know, like they drive in circles for like a whole 2 hours. What are you talking about? And you know, like Safety Car came out, and I was like, okay, I'll see you later, Dad. And as I got older, not necessarily F1, but like we like our cars. We've done a couple of track days, a couple of karting days, like nothing like I am diehard motorsports fan. That's, you know, just how life is. And especially sort of like where I'm from, you know, seeing stuff on TV, you're like, that's not going to be my life. You know, we don't go on TV. We just get a normal 9-to-5 and that's us done type folks. That's who we are. So it was never I want to work in motorsport, because it didn't feel obtainable, and I didn't have that sort of connection with it. You know, I saw cars on a screen. I was like, well, I'm not going to be a driver because one, they're all blokes, and well, what other jobs do they do? I don't know. So, you know, kind of went on with my life. Just kind of did what I enjoyed at school. And then when it got to going to uni, I was like, okay, whew, what do we go into here? You know, there wasn't a LinkedIn. Maybe there was right at the beginning. Not sure. But there wasn't like the ways of reaching out to folks and asking questions about, you know, their career path, how they got into things, that kind of thing. So it was more of a, you know, finger in the air, kind of Googling a couple of jobs, like, okay, how do you do that? So I ended up doing an economics degree. And, you know, if I'd had my time again, I probably wouldn't have done. But anyway, that's what happened. I did. And, you know, even then I was like, okay, what the hell do I do with an economics degree? Like, and, you know, you talk to your classmates, I'm like, what are you doing? Oh, I'm going into investment banking, right? What are you doing? Oh, I'm going into tax. Oh, what are you doing? Oh, insurance. Okay, fine. So, you know, you get your internship, you hope to go back. And anyway, I had an internship in an insurance company who then didn't take any of us interns on, so that was a bust. So it was back to the drawing board. And yeah, I did a I then just applied for a grad job at one of the investment banks, which I got, was in. You know, wasn't expecting that at all. I was like, okay, guess I'm gonna work in finance. And did that gig for about 5 years, predominantly in client relationship management, which, you know, it was a funny one because a lot of it was, you know, busting out issues that these folks had, or looking at their contracts and repapering and all. Like, it's not even worth me going into because it's so niche. And after 5 years, I was like, okay, not feeling this anymore. You know, let's try something different, you know, which for a start is really hard to do. I think it maybe took probably a year and a half, if not more, to convince myself that I wanted to do something else. And that was really hard to kind of be honest with myself about. I was like, no, I do like it here. You know, I'm going to be a banker. Which when you're in it, you're like, am I weird that I don't want to be here? Like, but that's totally fine. I think through growing up, I'm like, no, I totally did the right thing. But when you first have those doubts and you're like, oh, but this is going to be the job for the rest of my life, because, you know, I look at my parents and they pretty much did the same job their entire lives. It's not like now where, you know, folks do what they want. If they don't like it, they go somewhere else. You know, the world's changed. So after making that decision, I was like, okay, what do we do now? What do I like? And then that's where I started thinking about, okay, what do I actually like to do? And I'm a very solutions-based kind of person, so I like working towards a goal. I was like, oh, okay, that's one thing. I'm pretty organized. Okay, I can talk to folks. Okay. And the more I started thinking about it, I was like, okay, what about being a project manager? Let's investigate that. And that's when I started off in the rail network. Again, so random. And you know, I did that for maybe just over a year. Learned a lot about well, electronic control switches and substations and stuff, because specifically I was project managing within well, I was a sponsor at the time, which is, let's not even go into that because that's not worth explaining either, but it was in electrical safety. I mean, I don't even know I ended up in that department, but I was like, okay, gonna learn some stuff here, which I did. And I was like, okay, I've been project managing for a year and a bit now. This industry is not my gig. That's fine. Okay, I'm now, let's say, mature enough to admit that to myself. Okay, we've done this before. We're safe now. The world didn't end. I can admit that I don't like doing this anymore, and we'll do something else. And geographically, I was like, okay, I live in Milton Keynes now. Hey, Rebel Racing are based here. What? What's all that about? Okay. Let's delve deeper into this. It's like, you know, learning how businesses work. They are a business. They must have project managers, right? I didn't know. And you know, did a little look on LinkedIn. I was like, wow, as if they were actually hiring the project manager role in fan engagement. Hmm. I was like, you know, I'm gonna go for it. Got to. It was still in sort of the COVID time, so I had a couple of Teams interviews, and then when I got that call back saying, hey, you know, you got the role, I was like, wow, okay, this is going to be different, and it is, and it's incredible. And obviously, you know, you say you've not always been a motorsports fan. I said, well, I am now. I think it'd be really difficult for me to do what I do and no, not follow it. So yeah, that's sort of been, okay, fam, get involved, because guess what? Every race weekend, what we're doing, we got to watch it. and now we kind of, you know, we're like, okay, what time's quality, right? Okay, what time's the race? Okay, so this is what we're going to have to plan our weekend around. But they love it as well, which, I mean, they could have turned around and said, no, get out of here. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'll watch it by myself. But no, it's not been like that. And I even have, like, my parents, they'll message me on, like, a Saturday night, and be like, good luck for the race tomorrow. I'm like, thanks, team. Like, genuinely, and they've really got on board with it. And my partner's stepdad is Dutch.
Okay.
So it goes without saying that he's a massive Max fan. But again, without sort of my ties to the sport, I don't think, you know, he'd be watching it. But no, it's just sort of an added bonus that, you know, he's got some sort of relation who sometimes sees a driver every now and again. So it's been a whole thing.
I think the biggest takeaway from that story, like what I heard, which is really rare, like really rare in people to self-evaluate like that, where you stop and you look up from your cubicle and you kind of look around, or look up from your office and you're like, that person's been here for 20 years and they're miserable and angry and whatever. I don't think I want that. And like, and then you start asking yourself those questions, like, do I want to be here? Is there something else out there that is more fulfilling or whatever? And I think it's
not an easy thing to do. Really isn't. And it's scary. It is scary. You're like, you start to doubt yourself. You're like, there's something wrong with me. Like,
now that you've done it, it's like, it's not hard anymore, because you know what the other side of that decision looks like. And for me, when I left the company that I worked at, it was very much that self-reflection moment of like, I loved what I did. I enjoyed my clients, I enjoyed the business, I enjoyed a lot of those things, but you know, I would just stop and I would look at everyone around me and I would say, like, they're very angry, they're very antisocial, you know, they're doing all these things that I don't fancy myself as wanting to do in the future, and I just, like, I have this itch I've got to scratch. And it was very hard. It was very difficult to make that decision. And now, like, to like have an itch and scratch it is really easy, because it's just like, I like this, I'll stay. I don't like this, I leave. And it's a really empowering place to live when you understand that, like, it's just a job. Like, at the end of the day,
totally.
It's just a job. It's not your identity. It's not any of that. And like, do you enjoy what you do, and are you fulfilled by it? And I could imagine being around Formula One or any sort of motorsport, like, you have such a common core objective that is often diluted in most businesses, because the objectives are so broad that, like, it's easy to lose focus that your kind of common objective is to win championships. you know, and like you particular is to like unify the team and to win a championship. So it's very crystal clear, I think, and Red Bull Racing and any team, like we know why we're here, and that's a very clear objective. And like to have like your family so ingrained in what you do is probably a huge motivation to like have dad call and be like, good luck. I know you have so much control over Max's results, but like, but I'm a dad to a daughter. And if she was in Formula One, I would say the same thing. And like, and I just, you know, I could see where that's really, really self-fulfilling. And
it's really, really nice. Yeah.
in every story and almost every interview that I've had on my show, when I go back, like where was this triggered? It's always mom or dad was a Formula One fan. You know, mom raced go-karts, or, you know, dad spent the weekend watching Formula One races, and I just sat there, you know. And it's really cool to hear that, because my kids for a long time were just like, oh, it's a race, I'm out. And I'm sitting on the couch by myself, you know, or my wife will come sit there just to hang out and whatnot. But now they're like, because I've taken them to races and they've kind of like been in the environment of it, they'll sit down now and they'll get more engaged. And my daughter sent the text like 2 weeks ago, and she's like, how would I go about racing go-karts? And I was like, by sending this text. That's all it takes. You've just made that,
that's incredible. I love that.
So what in several years in the sport, and you know, being at the factory, being at the track, being around that, what's been your pinch me moment in your career?
I think there's been two. One track side and one not. So I'd say the first was last year. So I was super fortunate to be working on a fan event in Las Vegas. They did a show run over a weekend last year to promote that the race is coming. And so we were putting on a fan zone in the Hard Rock over that weekend, which, you know, we didn't advertise, we just kind of turned up, and folks were walking past like, well, what are you doing here? It was like, hey, come on here, guys. And before we set up the kit, I got the day before, and there were some more of the marketing team that were out, and they were filming the Vamos de Vegas piece, the Checo driving around Vegas in the desert, that kind of thing. You've probably seen it. Mm-hmm. And they said, hey, you know, if they're still setting up today, do you want to come in and see some of the recording? I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm jet lagged, I'm up at 5, let's go. So I got an Uber. got the app out, got an Uber, and this is the first time in my life I've ever had to put coordinates in an Uber versus in an address, because we were literally going to the middle of nowhere in the desert. And the guy comes and he picks me and one of my colleagues up, and he's like, are you sure this is where you're going? Like, there's nothing there. And we're like, yeah, we're sure. Like, we're doing a filming thing. When we get there, we should see some like trailers and stuff. He's like, okay. So we're driving out there, it's pitch black, you can't see anything, and I'm kind of like there out the window, like, when are we going to see some stuff? And we must have been about 100 meters away from this location, and I'm looking at the map on my phone, and I'm looking around, and there is nothing to be seen. And we keep going, and we just come over the brew of this hill, and I'm like, oh my god, we're here. And there was this pickup truck with the car sat on the back of it, and the engineers all gathered around to get the car off this pickup and, you know, move it. And there's like these huge trailers, like you see on movie sets, not that I know what a movie set looks like, but what I've seen on films of movie sets. And okay, all right, okay. And we walked down just this like dirt track. I'm like, what even is this? It's like some, it was some sort of lake, like a salt plain thing. Uh-huh. Oh, okay. And there's this huge 4x4 with one of these camera cranes on top of it. I'm like, cool, never seen one of them before. And we keep going, and the trophy trucks there, and the cars that, and the sun starts to rise, and I'm like, okay, I'm in the middle of the Nevada desert with an F1 car, a trophy truck, and a full film crew. This is unbelievable. Like, I have never, ever experienced anything like that in my life, nor did I ever think I would. I was like, you know, I feel very, very lucky and grateful to have seen that. So the whole stunt of the F1 car driving and the trophy truck jumping over the top of it, yes, it was real. I can guarantee that. I saw it with my own eyes. They did it several times. And the last time, they're like, oh, that got a little close. Okay, we're cutting. All happened. Unbelievable. And then back on the strip, seeing the car go up and down, racing the Bellagio fountains. Like, who gets to do that? Like,
no one.
Mind blown. So yeah, that will be ingrained in my brain forever. That was unbelievable. And the second one, which is quite funny, we were at the Zandvoort Grand Prix last year, and Max had just won, and we were getting ready for the team photo, my first ever team photo, my first and only ever team photo. And I ended up with an armful of these, you know, the Jumbo capes, the orange capes, and yeah, getting all the team to wear one for the team photo. And I just see this like camera heading towards me. I'm like, oh no, what's happening here? And it's Ted, and he's filming Ted's notebook. And he's like, oh, and here's Katie with the capes. And I'm like, oh God, please don't talk to me. Just kind of awkwardly waving and handed him one. It's like, I have no idea what to do in this situation. And, you know, he kind of like unraveled it and was talking to the camera about how we're setting up a team photo and handed it back to me. And that was that, thank God. But in my mind, I was like, you know, this just doesn't happen to people. So there's my two that are most prominent in my brain right now, and both of them just left me afterwards thinking, what just happened?
Do you know Ted?
No, not at all. So we have our names printed on our team polos, and that was part of the spiel. He was like, oh, Red Bull have their names printed on their team polos. How helpful! And I was just like, this is crazy. And so, like, I'm like, my partner's at home watching the race, and he's there WhatsApping me. He's like, what the hell are you doing on Ted's notebook? I'm like, I don't know.
I don't get like fanned out. Like, people are people to me. Like, and I,
totally.
I appreciate and respect people's jobs and stuff like that. And, you know, when I started this podcast, I've always really liked kind of adversity stories. And so I was like, man, I gotta get Grosjean on the show. Like, I gotta get this guy on the show. And so I email him, he emails me back, and he's like, you know, I'm really busy. You know, he's driving like 15 series, and like, he's just a really busy guy. And I always expect that to actually be like his manager or like his personal assistant responding back, and have been unable to connect our schedules. And I was in Miami, and I was in the, like the F1 experiences area, and he was speaking, and I was like, I'll go over and say hi, you know, I'll ask him to be on the show. Maybe if he doesn't email me back, I'll just ask him in person. And, you know, I just casually walked up after all the fans were done doing the whole selfie thing. And I walked over, and as I was walking up, he like looked at me and turned to me, and he's like, hey, Ryan. And I was so taken back that he knew who I was, that I was like, it almost like appeared like I was starstruck, because I was like, I was not expecting that. I was going in for the sale, and like he just like closed it, and I was like, I actually don't know how to respond to that. I was like, good to see you. Got to get you on the show, whatever. And it was like, I was out. It was so like distracting to me that I walked away, and my son was like, what was that? And I was like, he knew my name, and I just, my mind went blank, and that was probably a super embarrassing moment for me, and I'm out.
At least knew your name. Like,
yeah,
Ted,
yeah.
Literally, all he had to do was read it. Like, I'm not going to pretend by any means anyone knows who I am. They don't, and they shouldn't.
What didn't you expect about the world of racing or working in Formula One?
I mean, I did not know what to expect at all. You know, I walked in from a incredibly corporate roles, like super corporate, very, you know, straight laced, and these are the rules and regulations and, you know, all this. So going into a marketing role, you know, obviously there are rules and regulations in F1. Going into a marketing role is kind of like, oh, this is casual. not to be confused with unprofessional.
Yeah.
Very professional, just a super different tone that I really did not expect. And it's more of a kind of cut the crap sort of mentality. It's like, let's not use buzzwords for a start.
Thank you.
They come across really rare in motorsport. And it's like, just say what you mean. You know, we've got a race schedule. We've got stuff to achieve. So first and foremost, let's just make life easier for ourselves and just say what you mean, which I really appreciate. It's been so refreshing. But for some reason, I didn't necessarily expect that to be the case. You know, you pull off a super sleek event at these race weekends, you know, most of the time, you know, weather permitting and things like that, it goes off without a hitch. And it's just like, oh, okay, we could get stuff done and be professional, but it doesn't have to be, you know, throwing a buzzword every second sentence, which is great. I love that.
Yeah, I do too. I think that's where I have really enjoyed small business and just performance-based business, where it's like, yeah, we don't care. We don't care about the buzzwords. We don't care about the stuff. Like, let's just be very honest with each other and know that we have the best of intention and that communication. And if I have said something to offend you or off put you, know that my intentions were right and we can talk through that. And I've really appreciated companies like that. And I do see that a lot in Formula One. And my wife runs a marketing agency. And so when you talk about the differences between like the heavily regulated insurance and finance businesses versus like, you know, a roofing company, you know, it's very different voice brands that come across. And I always gravitate towards the speak freely, have fun, get somebody's attention.
For sure. I think sometimes I personally feel that it helps with relationships. And it helps build more of a bond because there's just less BS, you know. And I'm all here for that.
We don't. We have a very strong policy in our family of like we don't do superficial, and we just when we meet other families or other couples, it's like we are either. Like we're going to invest in this thing or we're not. And, you know, I've often heard, you know, well, they said this and it's like, well, if they said that, then they mean that because, you know, they generally don't play games or mess around. And, I appreciate that. I like that. Mm-hmm. What's been your greatest like learning moment? And like, you did come from the finance world. To Formula One and the peak of Formula One.
I mean, as I said, like I do not stop learning at all. Every day, it certainly is a school day. Sorry to use that term. It's hideous, but it's true. And wow, the biggest thing that I've learned, ooh, there's been so many. I would say, let's bring it back to the sort of the personal learnings. I think the greatest learning, I think, is to be honest with yourself. And I think when you're honest with yourself, you then can have a more honest and direct conversation with those around you. If you yourself don't know what you want, how the hell can anybody else know, how you are, how to deal with you? If you're pretending you're fine, in a role, then nothing's going to change. So it's learning that sometimes a little bit of confrontation, it's not even conversation, it's going back to just saying it how it is. And yes, it takes some time to finesse that and put it in a way of, hey, I'm not coming at you, but can we talk about this? Or, hey, this isn't really working. Is there a different way we can do it? And learning, proposing that solution when there is a problem. It's so easy to say, hey, this isn't working. Okay, so what? This isn't working, but we could do this. That goes way further than this isn't working. And when you have that solution ready, and this doesn't come overnight, this has been a whole thing of learning. Then I think the person on the opposite side of that conversation is way more receptive and like, oh, you might be onto something there. Or let's actually bounce off that idea and go somewhere else with it. And taking it to more of a collaborative space than a one-sided, I don't want to do this. That's a super vague answer, but
No, it actually carries more merit than I think maybe. And just the this is how I tell people these are not scripted conversations, is because when you have trouble answering, it's like, oh, okay.
yeah, I'm sure there's a way more concise and eloquent way of saying that, but
No,
take it.
I think in I always try to pull a lot of this back into outside of racing. And I think that it's really easy corporately to complain. This isn't working, it's too hard, this thing's broken, blah, blah, blah. And one thing that I myself respect and appreciate, as well as like watching other leaders and executives operate, is they pull away from that negativity. And it, you kind of just like detach from it. Whereas when you do have that, this thing is broken. However, I think we could fix it. Maybe the solution is dumb, but like you've brought a problem and a solution in a package, and it's less like energy sucking than it is like, I'm trying to help keep this thing on the rails. And I do think that that's great advice, and great insight. As much as you thought it wasn't something, I have a total takeaway from
Oh, I'm glad. I'm glad. Yeah, just I guess to summarize, bring something to the party. It's a starting point, no matter how, much of a rubbish idea it is. It's a starting point, and you build from there.
Now, to wrap it all up, I always ask this question. You're a great person to ask this question to. As a young person wanting something in motorsport, like what advice do you have for them? Because you didn't wake up one day, watch a race with your dad as a kid and want to be in the sport. You had a lot of life journey and arrived at this moment. Like, what advice do you have for young people?
Yeah, definitely. So I think that the first thing that I think you've got a your starting point is your frame of mind and you can't ever for one point think that you're not good enough to get there. So as your number one rule, you're absolutely good enough. Right. And that's super hypocritical of me to say it, because it's something you've got to remind yourself all the time. When you're surrounded by really talented people, it's so easy to be like, oh damn, am I good enough to be here? Yeah, you are. You wouldn't be there if you weren't. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing, in terms of like the journey of where you want to get to, it's incredibly rare to land your dream role at your dream company straight away. You know, that's almost never going to happen. So I would think about the role that you want. I'd think about the skills that role requires. And then you kind of take it from there. So, okay, you started a role. It might not even be a motorsport for a start. Let's start there. You might not even end up in motorsport to begin with. That, you know, as is life, it's hard. So, okay, you get a role that's not in motorsport. What do we do? You take everything from that role that you can. You get those skills, throw them on your CV, and you say, right, okay, what am I now? Where are my skills gap for that role that I want? Okay. There's a role that I've got skills for now. They're kind of transitional, and there's some stuff I can learn there to get me on my route to that motorsport role. Okay, that's your next goal. Go there then. Okay, you land that. Awesome. Take the skills there. Learn everything you can. Have as many conversations. Build a network. Like, that's the one thing when I first started my career, I was like, what? A network? Like, how do I even do that? Like, in plain terms, just make some damn friends. Like, just make some friends, okay? Let's get rid of that buzzword network. Thank you very much. Make some friends.
Thank you.
Then you have, eventually, if you keep doing that, you're going to have so many skills on your CV that role that you want in motorsport, it's going to be really hard for them to say no to you. And that's what you've got to do. You can't see a no as a rejection. Well, yeah, it's a rejection, but it's an opportunity to try something else and then go again, because you're never going to do a role and not learn something new from it. And so with that and the mentality that you are good enough, you'll get there eventually.
That's great advice. That's advice that I would give any young person in any career, I'd hang on to that. Like, anyone listening, hang on to those words. Katie, thank you for coming on the show. Seriously, you've been a blast. I love all these people that I have on the show, and you didn't disappoint at all.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been really nice.
I'm excited to follow your career. So as you hit this next step, you can come tell us what that role is. So get a bunch of titles so we can have you on.
I'll try my best.
I'm on this journey. No, really, I sit on LinkedIn and I, you know, I like put all the teams in the search, and then I just look at all the titles and I was like, what's a model maker? You know, and it's like, okay. I think I had a Red Bull model maker on the show, and it was just like, you know, trying to find all these unique different titles on the show, and it's been so fun.
No, but thank you for even making the show. I would have loved to have had something like this back when I was figuring out what to do with life. Still am.
So you would have never had those life lessons for your CV that you talked about. It's a good thing.
All pros and cons.
Katie, seriously, thank you. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks, Ryan. It's been awesome.